It's rather obviously not literal, because Israel never was up into heaven. And to cast down from heaven to earth is something that is a figurative expression of casting down from a pinnacle of privilege and splendor down to, you know, shame and contempt and disaster. Now, by the way, the same thing is said of Capernaum by Jesus when he weeps. Well, he doesn't exactly weep, I guess, but he does speak imprecations or something like that against Capernaum and Chorazin. But in Matthew 11:23, Jesus says, "And you, Capernaum, who are exalted into heaven, will be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained to this day." Notice he says Capernaum is exalted into heaven. Not literally, of course. Figuratively. But will be brought down to Hades. Just a figure of speech, of course. But we have a similar thing said about Edom in the book of Obadiah. A very short book, only one chapter, right after the book of Amos. And Obadiah verses 3 and 4, it is said about Edom, which of course was destroyed in pre-Christian times, "The pride of your heart has deceived you. You who dwell in the clefts of the rock," meaning the rock city of Petra, their capital, "whose habitation is high, you who say in your heart, 'Who will bring me down to the ground?' Though you exalt yourself as high as the eagle, and though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the Lord." Now, the reason I point these things out is because we need to be familiar with the imagery the prophets use so we don't misinterpret certain passages. And one passage that has been very much misinterpreted, to my mind, by the failure to recognize this kind of imagery is Isaiah 14 in the passage about Lucifer. Because, as you know, Lucifer has traditionally been identified with an angel in, you know, traditional theology. But the only place that he's mentioned in the Bible is in Isaiah 14:12, and then only in the King James and the New King James, because the other versions just translate the word Lucifer as son of the morning or star of the morning or something like that. But the reason that some have felt that Lucifer is a superhuman being, although the evidence from the context is Lucifer is just another term used to denote the king of Babylon, is because of what it says in verses 13 and following. Isaiah 14:13 says, "For you have said in your heart, 'I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I also will sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High.'" Then verse 15 says, "Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol," or hell, "to the lowest depths of the pit." Some say, well, no human being could make such claims as this. This must be an angel or someone like that. But they fail to recognize that when he says, "I will ascend into heaven, I'll exalt my throne above the stars of God," these are the exact same words said of Edom. "Though you set your throne above the stars of God, yet you'll be brought down." Or of Capernaum, "Though you be exalted into heaven, you'll be brought down to hell." The very same words. And even in Lamentations 2, it speaks of the condition of Israel before she fell, or Judah before she fell, as being in heaven. He says, "And God has cast you down from heaven to the earth." It's just a figure of speech, of course. But we recognize it as a figure of speech in all other places. The important thing is that we don't forcibly and artificially take it literally in the case of Lucifer, as if to preclude the possibility of Lucifer being merely the king of Babylon. What is said of Edom and Capernaum and Jerusalem could also be said of Babylon in that respect. Okay, let's go on. Lamentations 2:2. "The Lord has swallowed up and has not pitied all the inhabitants of Jacob. He has thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He has brought them down to the ground. He has profaned the kingdom of and its princes. He has cut off in fierce anger every horn of Israel," which the horn in Hebrew poetry usually refers to power, normally political or military power, so it may just refer to the armies, or it may refer to the powerful individuals. Every horn in Israel has been cut down. "He has drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. He has blazed against Jacob like a flaming fire which devours all around. Standing like an enemy, he has bent his bow With his right hand, like an adversary, he has slain all who were pleasing to his eye. He's not really saying that the people who were truly pleasing to God were slain. After all, Jeremiah is an example of the remnant who were really pleasing to God who were not slain. He's speaking of the people of Judah in general as those that God had formerly treated with deference, that he had treated them as those that he had pleasure in. He had blessed that nation previously, and now he's shot at them. That's what he's saying. He's not making a reference to individuals who truly have pleased him. More, he's speaking figuratively of the nation was once a nation pleasing to him, and now he's taken his vengeance on them for their sins. On the tent of the daughter of Zion, he has poured out his fury like fire. Verse 5. The Lord was like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all of her palaces. He has destroyed her strongholds and has increased mourning and lamentation in the daughter of Judah. He has done violence to his tabernacle, as if it were a garden. He has destroyed his place of assembly, that is, the temple. The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. In his burning indignation, he has spurned the king and the priest. The Lord has spurned his altar. He has abandoned his sanctuary, again referring to the temple there. He has given up the walls of her palaces into the hand of the enemy. They have made a noise in the house of the Lord as on a day of set feast. On the set feasts, the Jews would usually make a lot of noise of singing and celebration and partying and so forth, and feasting. Now Jeremiah is aware of noises in the same region where the feasting usually was taking place, but of a very different sort. A cry of victory on the part of the oppressors who busted through the walls and taken the sanctuary. The Lord has purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He has stretched out a line. He has not withdrawn his hand from destroying. Therefore, he has caused the rampart and the wall to lament. They languish together. Her gates have sunk into the ground. He has destroyed and broken her bars. Her kings and her princes are among the nations. The law is no more, and her prophets find no vision from the Lord. One of the ways that God exhibited his displeasure in judgment was that he would no longer speak to the prophets. Now, he spoke to Jeremiah at this time, and apparently Habakkuk and Zephaniah, but they were no longer heard. When Jerusalem fell, no one was listening to them. I mean, the prophets were no longer basically heard by the majority of them anyway. When it says her prophets find no vision from the Lord, it's probably a reference mostly to the professional prophets. There were a few true prophets like Ezekiel who prophesied to the exiles in Babylon and Daniel. But there were professional prophets, as we know, who even resisted Jeremiah. When Jeremiah put the yoke on him, one of the professional prophets broke the yoke and said, this is how the yoke of Babylon is going to be broken and so forth. They were false prophets. But the law is no more, of course, doesn't mean that the law has been abrogated at that time, but rather that it no longer is being practiced. The law required certain festivals and sacrifices to be observed. Without a temple, you can't do that. And so it's as if the law had ceased to be practiced and God was not speaking to his people anymore through prophets, at least through the phony prophets. They weren't even claiming to have visions anymore. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground and keep silence. Sitting on the ground as opposed to on their thrones suggests humility or just total humiliation, more like. They throw dust on their heads and gird themselves with sackcloth. The virgins of Jerusalem bow their heads to the ground. My eyes fail with tears. My heart is troubled. My bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, because the children and the infants faint in the streets of the city, probably meaning for lack of food. They say to their mothers, where is grain and wine? As they swoon like wounded in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out, even in their mother's bosom. The life of an infant being poured out or ebbing away, even while they're being held at their mother's breast, is fairly familiar to us in our time because of the graphic pictures we've seen not too many years ago of problems in Ethiopia and before that in Biafra and other places where you see pictures of women, you know, and starving babies at their breasts because their breasts, the women themselves have no food and they have nothing to give to the babies. That apparently was part of the results of the famine also in Jerusalem. How shall I console you? To what shall I liken you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I compare with you that I may comfort you, O virgin daughter of Zion? For your ruin is spread wide as the sea. Who can heal you? Again, the healing motif, the sickness motif, the condition of being under God's judgment was what is considered to be sickness, and there was no one who could heal the nation at that point. Your prophets have seen for you false and deceptive visions. They have not uncovered your iniquity. That is, they have not exposed your sin. False prophets generally said what you want to hear. True prophets were sent usually to expose the sins of the people and to warn of judgment. The false prophets did not uncover their iniquity. That is, they did not expose sin, and therefore they gave false and deceptive visions to bring you back. They did not expose your iniquity to bring back your captives, but have envisaged or envisioned for you false prophecies and delusions. Was there a hand up? Crystal, did you hear? All who passed by clapped their hands at you. They hiss and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. Is this the city that is called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? The joy of the whole earth and the perfection of beauty is a term for Jerusalem that we find in Psalm 48 in verse 2. You may know verses 1 and 2 because it has long been sung in Christian circles. But it's great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, meaning Jerusalem, in the mountain of his holiness, meaning Zion. Beautiful for situation, which means beautifully located. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. On the sides of the north, the city of the great king. The joy of the whole earth is a term that is used for it. And here, also in Lamentations 2:15, is this the city that was called the perfection of beautiful beauty and the joy of the whole earth? By the way, again, earth could be translated land. I don't know that it was ever thought that Jerusalem was rejoiced in by all the people of the earth, all the nations. After all, most of the nations of the earth were fairly oblivious to Israel most of the time. Although there were Jews scattered throughout the earth, and therefore in most of the countries there were people who rejoiced in Jerusalem and made pilgrimages to Jerusalem, but it's also entirely possible that joy of the whole earth should be translated joy of the whole land of Israel. That is, all of Israel looked to Jerusalem as the place of rejoicing and feasting and worship. All your enemies have opened their mouth against you. They hiss and gnash their teeth. They say, "We have swallowed her up. Surely this is the day we have waited for. We have found it. We have seen it," say to her enemies. "The Lord has done what he purposed. He has fulfilled his word, which he commanded in days of old. He has thrown down and he has not pitied. He has caused your enemy to rejoice over you. He has exalted the horn of your adversaries. Their heart cried out to the Lord. O wall of the daughter of Zion, let tears run down like a river day and night. Give yourself no relief. Give yourself no rest. Arise, cry out in the night. At the beginnings of the watches, pour out your heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift your hands toward him for the life of your young children, who faint from hunger at the head of every street. See, O Lord, and consider, to whom have you done this? Should the women eat their offspring, the children that they have cuddled? Should the priest and the prophet be slain in the sanctuary of the Lord? Young and old lie on the ground in the streets. My virgins and my young men have fallen by the sword. You have slain them in the day of your anger. You have slaughtered and not pitied. You have invited as to a feast day the terrors that surround me. In the day of the Lord's anger, there was no refugee or survivor. Those whom I have born and brought up, my enemies have destroyed." Those my own children that I bore and brought up have been destroyed by the enemies too. He compares the terrors that came upon, of course meaning the invading army, as those that have been invited to a feast, to feast on Jerusalem, that is. It's as if God invited them to a feast. You know, Jesus told a parable in Matthew 22 of a wedding feast, and he said a king wanted to make a wedding for his son, and he sent out messengers to invite people to the feast, and the first people invited, apparently in the parable, represent the Jews, and they made excuses and didn't come. It says he was wroth with them and he sent his armies and destroyed their city. A reference to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. This is Matthew 22, the first parable in that chapter. Then it says, then he sent out his messengers to the highways and byways, apparently representing the Gentiles, and compelled them to come in. And then the feast was furnished with guests. But it's interesting, there's two feasts, as it were. Here is the feast where the people of the Gentiles come and feast on Jerusalem. But there's also the feast of salvation, that people are invited to. And the Jews who rejected the Feast of Salvation, that refused to come invited into the kingdom of God to receive Christ, they had to participate in as the hors d'oeuvres of the feast of the wicked that came against them. Likewise, in Revelation 19, we read of two feasts, and the same contrast is made. One, the feast, the wedding feast of the Lamb, wedding supper of the Lamb. The other is a feast of carnivorous birds coming to eat the wicked who have been slain. We see, for example, in Revelation 19:9, "Then he said to me, Write, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, These are the true sayings of God." But then, in verse 17 of the same chapter, Revelation 19:17, "Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, Come and gather yourself together for the supper of the great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of captains, and the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses, and those who sit on them, the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great." So we have two feasts, beginning contrast. Come to the feast of the Lamb, or be feasted upon by the vultures, as it were. And if, again, if Revelation is talking about the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, as some believe, and could be well argued, then it would be saying a similar thing. If they don't come to the wedding feast, then they will be part of the feast of the king sending his armies to destroy their city, and the vultures will eat them. And so also, when Jerusalem fell in 586 BC, the prophet likened it to the people being feasted on. Chapter 3 then, there's the I and me seen throughout this section that almost suggests the prophet would be speaking about himself, and it can sound like he is, but in all likelihood he's personifying the nation and speaking as a representative of the nation. So it's like the nation is speaking in a first person singular. Though later on, at about verse 52, there's some reason to believe that maybe the prophet's speaking for himself. It's not all that clear. But at least some of this is not speaking about himself so much as about the nation itself. "I am the man who has seen affliction by the rod of his wrath," of God's wrath. "He has led me and made me walk in darkness and not in light. Surely he has turned his hand against me time and time again throughout the day. He has aged my flesh and my skin and broken my bones. He has besieged me," which sounds more like a city speaking than an individual, "and surrounded me with bitterness and woe. He has set me into dark places like the dead of long ago. He has hedged me in so that I cannot get out. He has made my chain heavy. Even when I cry and shout, he shuts out my prayer. He has blocked my ways with hewn stone. He has made my paths crooked. He has been to me like a bear lying in wait, like a lion in ambush." He's saying God has been like that, although in the book of Jeremiah, Babylon is called a lion, or Nebuchadnezzar is called a lion, crouching and coming against Jerusalem. See, Jerusalem is likened in the scripture to God's flock of sheep. The enemies of Jerusalem, or of Israel, the Gentiles, are usually compared to carnivorous beasts that are the typical enemies of sheep. And Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar himself is likened unto a lion in the book of Jeremiah, although here it's the Lord has been like a lion tearing at the flock instead of like a shepherd, because they're no longer his flock. "He has turned aside my ways and torn me in pieces. He has made me desolate. He has bent his bow and set me up as a target for his arrow. He has caused the arrows of his quiver to pierce my loins. I have become the ridicule of all my people and their taunting song all the day. He has filled me with bitterness. He has made me drink wormwood," which also means bitterness. "He has also broken my teeth with gravel and covered me with ashes." This is all probably figurative, but there's, in the literal sense too, the city of Jerusalem was covered with ashes when it was burned up. "Broken my teeth with gravel" might even be a reference to the famine, that after, you know, pure food supplies were gone, they'd eat maybe food that was mixed with, you know, sand or whatever, or gravel, that would break their teeth. But it's also entirely possible this is just figurative language and not a reference to those particular things. "You have moved my soul far from peace. I have forgotten prosperity. And I said, my strength and my hope have perished from the Lord. Remember my affliction and roaming, my wormwood and my gall. My soul still remembers and sinks within me. This I recall to my mind. Therefore I have hope. Now, at verse 22, which is just about the middle of the book, just about the center, we have an unusually optimistic and positive passage. Whereas the book is entirely made up of laments over destruction and so forth, we have here a bright spot of hope right in the middle of the book, which looks forward to God's restoration and mercies and so forth. He says in verse 22, through the Lord's mercies, we are not consumed, because his compassions do not fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Now you know where that song comes from. In spite of the appearances to the contrary, God is still merciful, and those who look for him and who are in relationship with him can still find every day evidences of his loving kindness, his mercy, even in the midst of destruction and general devastation of the society around. Individuals can certainly know his mercy, and even the destruction of Jerusalem could be seen as an act of mercy, because it was a discipline that was intended to rid them of the idolatry that would be forever in them and destroying them if he hadn't done it. So even in wrath, he remembers mercy. Even in the judgments of God, those who have faith can recognize the compassion of the Lord. He's faithful to his people. He didn't just leave them. He judged them so that they might change and not be condemned of the world. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. So many people in Jerusalem could not claim God had been good to them in the sense that he had wiped them out and their children had starved or been slain in the streets. But those who wait for him, those that remnant who believed in him, like Jeremiah himself, could see the goodness of God toward him. After all, he escaped all this. It is good that one should hope and wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man to bear the yoke in his youth. This verse is often quoted, though I'm not sure exactly what it means. It suggests possibly that if a person has to be in slavery, it's better for it to be in his younger years so that he can learn his lessons of humility and hard work and so forth, and it will condition his thinking for the rest of his life. And he may be seeing that Jerusalem is like a man who is bearing the yoke now, so that it will have a better perspective, more humility later in life. Let him sit alone and keep silent, because God has laid it on him. Let him put his mouth in the dust, yet that there may be yet hope, or there may yet be some hope. Let him give his cheek to the one who strikes him, and be full of reproach. Now he's basically saying, just receive this from the hand of God. Turn the other cheek, as it were. By the way, in a messianic passage in Isaiah 50 and verse 6, the Messiah says, I gave my cheek to the smiters, and did not turn away from him that plucked out the hair, meaning the beard was plucked out. Same kind of language is here. Let him give his cheek to the one who strikes him and be full of reproach. Rather than retaliating, just receive it. Just absorb the judgment and chastisement of the Lord, and hopefully it'll pass. Eventually God will feel like you've absorbed enough, and he'll remove the affliction, is what is implied here. For the Lord will not cast off forever. Though he causes grief, yet he will show compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. For he does not afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men. That doesn't mean that something happened that was outside of God's will when they got grieved and afflicted. But it means that that's not what's really in his heart. That's not what his desire is. He doesn't desire to afflict people. He doesn't enjoy the death of the wicked. He sometimes has to do it in order to accomplish his overall will of correcting them, but it's not something that he exactly delights in. To crush under his feet all the prisoners of the earth, to turn aside the justice due to a man before the face of the Most High, or subvert a man in his cause. That's what it's not. God doesn't willingly do that. Doesn't like to do that. The Lord does not approve of those things. Although he has brought those things upon them, it is more or less a secondary measure that he had to bring on them, not what he really would prefer to have done. Their own conduct has required that he treat them this way. Who is he who speaks and it comes to pass when the Lord has not commanded it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that woe and well-being proceed? Now the prophet says that both woe and well-being proceed from God. Job said that too. Job said to his wife, shall we receive only good from the Lord and not the evil also? So we need to have room in our theology for God, a God who brings affliction. A God, it's not just the devil who does that. The devil may in fact be the agent, just as the Babylonians, who were wicked men, were agents that God used to bring affliction on Judah on this occasion. So also when affliction comes to us, the devil himself may be the agent, as he was in the case of Job. But God is the one who decrees it. God is the one who allows it. If God didn't speak it, the devil couldn't do it. And so Jeremiah and Job both have this perspective that woe and well-being both proceed from the mouth of the Lord. That is from God's command and ordering it to be so. Why should a living man complain, a man, for the punishment of his sins? Let us search out and examine our ways and turn back to the Lord. Let us lift our hearts and hands to the God of heaven. Now he's basically saying what the appropriate response is when God allows affliction in your life. No, don't complain. Receive it as something just, especially if it's chastisement for sins, and use that as an incentive to turn to God, to examine your ways and say, well, why is this happening to me? And then to turn to God and repent and return to the God of heaven. And so that's what Jeremiah recommends to his people there. We have transgressed and rebelled. You have not pardoned. You have covered yourself with anger and pursued us. Speaking to God this time. You have slain and not pitied. You have covered yourself with a cloud, as mentioned in chapter 2, verse 1, that prayer should not pass through. This time the cloud is not seen as obscuring the light of the sun and the moon and the stars, but being a barrier between man and God so that the prayers don't reach heaven. It's as if God has put something between himself and the people and their prayers are not reaching their goal in heaven. You have made us an offscouring and a refuse in the midst of the peoples. By the way, Paul uses this same reference to how the apostles are treated in 1 Corinthians 4:13. 1 Corinthians 4:13, he says, I believe that God has set us apostles as last and to live in more humiliation than the average people, at the offscouring and the refuse of the world in the midst of the peoples. All our enemies have opened their mouths against us. Now, by the way, I should point out that in Judah becoming offscouring and refuse, that's a judgment for her sins. The apostles are made that way not as a judgment, but simply as a calling. And therefore, what was seen in the Old Testament as something that only happened to people when they did something wrong, in the New Testament is seen as something people voluntarily take upon themselves when they take positions of responsibility as Christians. They accept the rejection of the world. They accept suffering at the hands of people. It's a very different kind of thing when the apostles are said to be in this category on the one hand, or when rebellious Israel is. Verse 46, now all of our enemies have opened their mouths against us. Fear and a snare have come upon us. Desolation and destruction. My eyes overflow with rivers of water for the destruction of the daughter of my people. My eyes flow and do not cease without interruption until the Lord from heaven looks down and sees. My eyes bring suffering to my soul because of all the daughters of my city. And that's what I see apparently brings suffering to my soul, unless he means the tears flowing from my eyes help to influence my soul to experience the proper grief. I'm not sure if that would be the case, although one could read it in the context that way. My enemies, without cause, hunted me down like a bird. Now here it says, without cause. Here's where I think we must have the prophet speaking for himself instead of for the nation. Because Jerusalem was hunted down, but not without cause. The prophet has already said that the nation was destroyed for good cause, because they offended the Lord, because they did things that brought this rightly upon themselves. However, Jeremiah was personally oppressed without cause. And so we can see, if you'll look at the following verses, that very possibly the prophet is speaking autobiographically here of his own situation. My enemies without cause hunted me down like a bird. They silenced my life in the pit and threw stones at me. The waters flowed over my head. I said, I am cut off. I called on your name, O Lord, from the lowest pit. You have heard my voice. Do not hide your ear from my sign, from my cry of help. This cannot be said of the nation at that point. They had not yet turned to the Lord, cried to the Lord, but Jeremiah perhaps in the pit could be said to have done so. You drew near on the day I called on you and said, do not fear. O Lord, you have pleaded the case of my soul. You have redeemed my life. O Lord, you have seen how I am wronged. Judge my case. You have seen all their vengeance, all their schemes against me. You have heard their reproach, O Lord, all their schemes against me, the lips of my enemies, and their whispering against me all the day. Look at their sitting down and their rising up. I am their taunting song. Repay them, O Lord, according to the work of your hands. Give them a veiled heart. Your curse be upon them. In your anger, pursue and destroy them from under the heavens of the Lord. Now, here in verses 64 through 66, we have a fairly typical imprecation. Now, this exact imprecation is not found in the book of Jeremiah, but Jeremiah has occasional imprecations of just this type. As you will recall, going through the book of Jeremiah, there are times when he just breaks into a wish of evil upon the people who have persecuted him. The psalmist, of course, does this as well from time to time. And one of the things he wishes upon them in verse 65 here is that they'd have a veiled heart. No doubt, immediately your mind is reminded of 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 14 through 16, which says that there is a veil over the hearts of the unbelieving Jews to this day. When Moses is read, there still remains a veil over their hearts, so they can't understand it or see it. And this is a judgment from God. In Romans 11, verses 7 through 8, it talks about how God has given the Jews a spirit of slumbers, eyes that cannot see and ears that cannot hear, even unto this day. That is, their hearts have been made hard and numb. Now, that wouldn't be true necessarily of every Jew today, especially those who become Christians. In fact, it says in 2 Corinthians 3, this veil is taken away in the Lord. When one turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. It says.
I don't understand. It seems like Jeremiah is lamenting, asking the Lord to relent, to take his hand of judgment away. And then he goes into this, like, no, don't stop.
I think that, yeah, it's a good point. If, on one hand, he seems to be praying for mercy for these people, and then there's an imprecation like this. I think the imprecation is specifically directed toward those who have opposed him. The mercy he asks is for the nation as a whole. But I think in the context, he's talking about how his enemies have persecuted him and resisted his ministry and so forth. And he's not wishing any special mercies on them, but just on the nation. Is that what you're going to say, Scott? Okay, we need to move along here if we're going to work it out. Chapters 4 and 5 are shorter. The first three chapters have been all equally long and quite long. But these are shorter chapters. Chapter 4 is two-thirds the length of the previous ones, and chapter 5 is one-third the length of the previous ones. So together, chapters 4 and 5 are just as long as each of the other chapters were. How the gold has become dim. How changed the fine gold. The stones of the sanctuary are scattered at the head of every street. There were lovely stones from which the Temple of Solomon had been built. And no doubt gems and gold and so forth, we know were a major part of the architecture. Now it's just been scattered. The temple is just made of rubble. At the head of every street you'll find bits of the temple and the precious stones and so forth. The precious sons of Zion, valuable as fine gold. He now shifts it to thinking from the literal stones of the temple to the individuals who are precious as gold, the inhabitants of Judah. How are they regarded as clay pots instead of gold? And the work of the hands of the potter, they're treated as if they're worthless, in other words, rather than fine vessels for honor. Even the jackals present their breasts and nurse their young, but the daughter of my people has become cruel like ostriches in the wilderness. The tongue of the infant clings to the roof of its mouth for thirst. The young children ask for bread, but no one breaks it for them. Now, of course, the reason the mothers were not giving food to their children is they didn't have any in the famine. That's what's being referred to. But he says it looks more cruel than even what the animals do. Even jackals, unclean animals, can be expected to show compassion to their young and feed them when they're hungry. But here the people of Israel, God's own people, are cruel, like the ostriches of the wilderness. Of course, ostriches don't nurse their young. And if I knew more about ostriches, I might even be able to tell you some ways they exhibit cruelty. In Job chapter 39, verses 14 through 17, we have a reference also to the behavior of ostriches. Job 39, verses 14 through 17 says, for the speaking, and this talks about the cruelty of the ostrich to her young. Verse 13 actually, the wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are her wings and pinions like the kindly storks? For she, that is the ostrich, leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them, or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly, as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain, without concern, because God deprives her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. So unlike the jackal that has some basic instincts of compassion to feed its infants, the bird-brained ostrich doesn't have enough common sense to even treat its young kindly. And so in Lamentations, Israel is contrasted unfavorably with an unclean animal like the jackal. The jackal is better and more compassionate toward its young than the Jews are showing themselves to be in the famine. And they're showing themselves to be like the ostrich, the empty-headed ostrich, that God hasn't given any wisdom or understanding and therefore shows cruelty toward the young. And that is how he describes the mothers depriving their children of food in the famine. Now, this might be partly because the women didn't have food. Obviously, it was because they didn't have an abundance of food. But it may well be that the mothers had some food and ate it themselves rather than giving it to their children. Josephus indicates that that happened in 70 A.D. Yes, Ray?
And why did the King James Version say sea monsters?
I don't know. I don't know why the King James says sea monsters there instead of jackals. But certainly, if sea monsters be understood to be whales, whales do nurse their young too. And they do bear the breast, as it were, to their young. So it would fit of them if whales be understood to be the sea monsters. But it would seem unlikely that Jeremiah would know even that whales were mammals and that they nurse their young. I mean, I don't think that biology had progressed so far in his day that they would make an identification of a whale with a mammal instead of a fish. But, I don't know. It must be one of those cases where the Hebrew can be pointed differently and to either read jackal or sea monster. Okay. Verse 5. Those who ate delicacies are desolate in the streets. Those who were brought up in scarlet embrace ash heaps. That's the people who were rich and lived luxuriously are in the opposite condition now. The punishment of the iniquity of the daughter of my people is greater than the punishment of the sin of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment with no hand to help her. That is, it's more merciful, as he'll say a little later too, to die instantly, like the people of Sodom did, than to languish in hunger and die slowly. We see that in verse 9, but we're not there yet. Verse 7. Her Nazarites were brighter than snow and whiter than milk. Of course, Nazarites were the most religious people of society. They took a vow of separation. And they were more ruddy in body than rubies, like sapphire in their appearance. Now their appearance is blacker than soot. They go unrecognized in the streets. Their skin clings to their bones. It has become as dry as wood. Brittle skin from apparently dehydration, lack of water supply during the famine. Those slain by the sword are better off than those who die of hunger. For these pine away, stricken for lack of the fruits of the field. The hands of the compassionate women have cooked their own children. They became food for them in the destruction of the daughter of my people. Another reference to the cannibalism during the siege. The Lord has fulfilled his fury. He has poured out his fierce anger. He kindled a fire in Zion, and it has devoured its fountains. The kings of the earth, by the way, devoured its foundations. Excuse me. Probably mean the actual physical foundations of the buildings of the city and the walls. They had to rebuild those, by the way, in the days of Zerubbabel. They had to relay the foundations. The kings of the earth and the inhabitants of the world would not have believed that the adversary and the enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem. Jerusalem had such magnificent walls. Even Titus, the Roman who destroyed Jerusalem, indicated that he made this statement that we have certainly had God on our side in this endeavor, he said, because what armies or machines of war could have overcome these towers? Jerusalem had powerful walls and towers, and basically no one would have thought it possible to overcome them. And that's what he's saying. The kings of the earth and the inhabitants of the world would not have believed that the adversary and the enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem, because the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests, who shed in her midst the blood of the just. Now let me just say something here. The walls of a city in those days were their national security, just like military might is the national security of our own culture. We don't have walls around our nation, but we have nuclear walls, as it were, and just who would dare to attack us for fear of retaliation from us? And yet this security is not enough if God finds the prophets and the priests to be sinful, if he finds innocent blood shed. No amount of earthly security, walls of the city or military might or whatever, none of those things can defend a nation against the wrath and judgment of God. Therefore, the greatest security for a nation, and the thing that will make it last longest, is not to have the largest walls or the largest military, but to have the most righteous population. And that is why, when people sometimes accuse Mennonites and other pacifist Christians of not being willing to defend their country when they take advantage of the benefits of this country, it is a false accusation. The fact of the matter is the Christian church, in promoting righteousness in society, is doing far more to preserve the country than those who go and serve in its military interests or who do anything to preserve it in through carnal security. You see, the church is the salt of the earth. It is the preservative of a society. And if the salt loses its savor, eventually that society is without salt and without redeeming value, and eventually God just removes it. And so here also, it is celebrated that Jerusalem's walls had been the marvel of nations, and people thought, well, no one could ever beat that country. But he says in verse 13, because the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests who shed their in her midst the blood of the just, that's why they fell, despite their walls. God saw occasion to destroy them. And when God has put had in his heart to judge a nation, no amount of earthly securities can change that. The shedding of the blood of the just for most of us would, in our own society, be analogous to, or not analogous to, but the same thing as what we have in abortion. Our culture does not yet tolerate outright murder on the streets, but it, although it's fairly light on penalties of murders, but it condones outright the murder of innocents. They wandered blind in the streets. They have defiled themselves with blood, so that no one would touch their garments. They cried out to them, "Go away, unclean! Go away, unclean! Do not touch us." When they fled and wandered, those among the nations said, "They shall no longer dwell here. The face of the Lord scattered them. He no longer regards them. The people do not respect the priests, nor show favor to the elders." It's an interesting thing when the religious leaders begin to compromise and get into sin. They often do so that they won't seem too aloof. They won't seem too holier than thou. They don't want to come off as overly pious or puritanical. They want, so they usually make their compromise in order to please the world and to obtain respect and acceptance in the world. That's the main reason that the clergy usually, start to champion things like